Yeah.
You talked about the universe being attracted towards its own completion.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not trying to trip you up in semantics or anything like that, but would it also be moving towards its own closure at that point?
You mean its completion closure?
Yeah.
Well, what does closure mean to you?
Well, I was relating it back to when we were talking before about closure not really existing.
Well, maybe what we should say is there's only one closure, and all others are false closure. Closure isn't really the word I would use. I steal shamelessly from Alfred North Whitehead, and probably others as well, but I'm willing to cop to that. He has this notion called concrescence, which I think is a great idea. He says everything grows toward a nexus of concrescence. So complexification is at the service of concrescence. We can see how this planet is caught in a concrescent process. 100 years ago, you know, it took 3 months to go around the world. Now it takes a third of a second. 100 years ago, a newspaper carried local news. Now local news means the news of this planet. We can telephone Prague or Shanghai by just going outside to the phone booth. We are being knitted more and more tightly together. Now, most people think this is a human world phenomenon and it will stop at some point with everybody connected to everybody else, I guess. I don't think it is a process of the human world. I think we're embedded in a collapse of physical law. This is a fairly pathological notion from the point of view of most scientists, because they believe that the universe will exist for, you know, millennia or millions of years into the future. But I think our presence on this planet indicates that we're deep into Act 3 of the cosmic drama. Yeah.
Well, if the universe were viewed as a setting for souls that intelligently evolve back to Godhead, when all the souls intelligently evolve, whatever aeons that may take, then when the set is disappeared, there would no longer be any need for the set of the physical universe.
Yes, I mean, in a way, the problem is not the problem is not the end of the universe, but why it existed in the first place. What happened to flaw the original nothingness, to contort itself into this fantastic cascade of interconnected complexity? It's very, very tricky, this stuff. I mean, you know, there, well, without dragging that in, it's tricky enough, so let's leave it at that, yes.
The philosophy and the thought science are pretty interesting, but I really came here to learn more about using the mathematics.
Oh, well, ask a question. Seize the tiller.
Everything you described, you take the pull of this all at once. Is that the best way to do it, in your opinion? I mean, sometimes I've taken four grams and start, and then three more later after.
Oh, I see what you're asking. Should you boost it? I don't like doing that simply because I like to get... I think the real action is in the flash. And the flash comes by getting as much of the material to the synapses in as coherent a wavefront as possible. So I tend not to do that. But to take an initial large dose. Of course, if you take an initial dose and it doesn't do anything, then you could follow it up.
Pardon?
You mean just to discuss it generally? Do you all know what ibogaine is? It's a psychedelic. It's an interesting one. One of the things interesting about it is how little people are aware of its existence. It's the root scrapings of an African small tree or bush called Tabernantha iboga. And interestingly enough, it's a true aphrodisiac, perhaps the only real aphrodisiac in the world, because what are called aphrodisiacs are usually either just stimulants or things which cause genital itching. But Ibogaine actually seems to be works on the psychology of sexual drive in some way. It's a powerful hallucinogen. One of the puzzling things about Ibogaine is that we can't confirm its use by human beings before 1850. And, you know, the Portuguese were into the areas of Africa where this is happening. They've been in there since the 1430s. So it probably is a new pattern of drug use that has arisen, and it's a major force among the Fang people of Zaire and Gabon, holding back Christianity and mission culture. And it's a visionary hallucinogen, without doubt.
How do you spell it?
Ibogaine. Probably in the future, eventually society will get around to exploiting this particular one, just like it does everything else.
Is this a Latin name, or is this a common name?
The drug is Ibogaine. The plant it comes from is Tabernantha Iboga. Yeah.
You mentioned combining DMT with harmony.
Mm-hmm.
What is the experience? What is the change in the experience?
Well, that's what ayahuasca is. You see, the DMT is then not destroyed in your intestine, and so you have a slow-release DMT trip by doing that.
Is that done with smoking DMT after ingesting hormone?
In theory, and probably in fact, that would be a tremendously successful way to get very loaded. The problem is it might be a too successful way. You want to be very careful with these MAO inhibitors. There are MAO inhibitors that drug companies have produced where a single dose inhibits all the MAO in your body for up to a month. This would be murder if you got around some DMT on that. The nice thing about harmine is that it's fully reversible in 4 to 6 hours. So it's a gentle MAO inhibitor. But yes, this is the strategy. This is why you could conceivably take the seeds of a plant like Pergamon harmala, which grows around here, more or less, and contains harmine, and combine it with a plant like Desmantha selenoiensis, which contains DMT, and come up with a North American pseudo-ayahuasca of some sort. People are doing this, but, you know, if you think it takes courage to just do these compounds naturally, imagine the kind of courage it takes to diddle with recipes and to do your own bioassay, which you must do, because the cook must taste the soup.
Terrence, what was this plant? Not the Desmanthus, but the other one?
Pergamon harmala, P-E-G-A-M-U-M, Pergamum harmala in the Zygophilaceae. Yeah.
I was just
wondering,
true hallucination, if you and Dennis ever tried to experiment again, if not, why not?
Well, we never tried the experiment again because Dennis felt that he'd really made the maximum contribution to the effort. There are many experiments, though, which could be tried, which would put no human being in danger. For instance, you could use square wave generators, which are acoustical generators, to try and drive these drug molecules into DNA in vitro, in a test tube. You know, what you would do is simply put the denatured DNA into solution, put some DMT into the solution, shake it furiously, ultra-centrifuge the mix to get the loose DMT out, and then weigh the DNA and see if its weight had increased by a number which was magically divisible by the molecular weight of the DMT molecule. these kinds of studies have been done and show that DMT does intercalate and locate itself into DNA. So, yeah, there are a lot of different things like that that could be done that wouldn't put anyone at risk.
So Dennis really felt that he was at risk in a very serious way.
Well, he doesn't remember it very clearly. His impression was that it lasted about 5 days. It actually lasted 3 weeks. So the real stuff that would have alarmed him, he fortunately was too out of it to see or remember. But I was there throughout the whole thing and saw it. And I think it would be nice to understand the parameters of the effect a little more clearly before we charge off and try that particular trick again. Yeah.
Can you tell me about that?
Well, this is what's being referred to is the In True Hallucinations, which is a tape set which will be published as a book next year. It describes an expedition to the Amazon in 1971. Which was really where we got the whammy. I mean, I'm still running on what happened from, you know, the 28th of February 1971 to the 21st of March. The rest of my life is pretty much throwaway. But I don't know, it was weirder than flying saucer abduction, because that now, there's a whole form for it. It was hard to say. Something was waiting for us down in the Amazon, and as soon as we started taking these mushrooms, it began making suggestions about how you could use the mushroom and your voice and certain other materials present at hand in that environment to essentially, there aren't even words to say what it was. Condense the soul into three-dimensional space, or create the philosopher's stone inside your body and then give birth to it, or, in other words, some radical transformation of the ontology of being human was held out as a possibility. And it all came down to an experiment that he wanted to perform that seemed to me so unlikely to have any effect whatsoever that I felt it was perfectly all right to let this experiment go forward, because I would have bet dollars to donuts that nothing would happen. Instead, all hell broke loose at the conclusion of this experiment, and you know, he claimed at the time that what he had done was bonded into my DNA enough psilocybin in a superconducting kind of bond, which, if you know how superconductivity works, a superconductive bond is very hard to disrupt. It's not like an ordinary chemical bond. And he felt that you could do what he called Bell the Cat, that you could actually hang a transceiver around the neck of the logos itself. And from then on, it would talk to you constantly in the confines of your own mind. And it just seemed so wildly improbable to me that it went forward. But in fact, at the conclusion of the experiment, something changed in me. And I essentially became who I now appear to be. But before that, I wasn't. I was sort of a wastrel and an undirected person of some sort. And then tomorrow you will see, when we get the computer, what the bottom line of this is, because what was eventually revealed was a kind of mathematical mandala of space and time that rested on its veracity on the fact that it allowed, that it made prediction of the future possible. And tomorrow afternoon I will display this thing for you, and you can judge for yourself whether this is the product of a pathological incident or in fact an intellectual leap comparable to Newton's laws of motion or something like that. I think in principle all this is possible. I think transforming, you know, part of what human history's conclusion will be is what I call turning the human body inside out. We want the soul to become visible. We want the body to become an idea freely commanded in the imagination. And then at that point, as James Joyce said, man will be dirigible. That was as close as he could get in 1939 to saying, you'll turn into a flying saucer. You know, he knew it was an airship, he knew it was oblate, but he thought it was a dirigible. Anyway, enough about La Cerrera. Maybe we'll get into that tomorrow. Yeah.
I just have a matter of clarification about the ayahuasca.
Uh-huh.
You said that it has the DMT and the Hamina.
Yes.
The vine
has that? No. Good point. The vine contains the harmine. Another plant contains the DMT. This makes ayahuasca unique among these shamanic tools, because you see all the rest of them, peyote, mushrooms, San Pedro, ibogaine, morning glories, and whatever else, cannabis, are simply plants which you ingest. Ayahuasca is a drug, a product, something made by pharmacologists. I mean, pharmacologists who wear penis sheaths, but pharmacologists nevertheless, you see. So suddenly, the human dimension enters into it. Not all ayahuasca is alike. Ayahuasca depends on the personality of the person who made it. So it's not about a relationship between you and a plant. When you take ayahuasca, between you and the plants, there stands a human being. And, you know, if you're headed down there to seriously get into this, don't give up in a hurry. You will drink a lot of swill before you find someone who is conscientious enough, honest enough, and cares about you enough to not shortchange you in some way.
How many used to be called telepathy?
Telepathine, yes. Ayahuasca was discovered by Richard Spruce in 1853, and then in the early years of the 20th century, the German ethnographer Theodor Koch-Grünberg brought a lot of it back to Berlin, and Louis Lewin and his group characterized an alkaloid, which they named telepathine. But it was not realized then until, I think, 1957 by the chemists Hochstein and Paradis that harmine or that telepathine was exactly the same compound as an earlier compound isolated from the Syrian rue named harmine. And since the rules of chemical nomenclature are that the first compound, the first name, takes precedent, telepathine had to be dropped and harmine substituted. But it tells you how convinced these early ethnographers were that this stuff was, you know, exciting paranormal mental abilities.
Are they taking the TNT or are they taking it by itself?
The harmaline?
Yeah.
Oh, well, no. See, what happened was what Koch-Grünberg took back to Berlin was the liana, the vine, Banisteriopsis caapi. The other active ingredient in ayahuasca was not isolated chemically until 1956.
But the guys who took the vine back and started playing with the vine.
The vine doesn't contain DMT.
Okay, but the harmine and harmaline itself?
Has an effect. At high doses, it can cause hallucination by itself. The plant which contains the DMT, normally, there are a couple of possible substitutes, but normally what's used in the Amazon is Socotria viridis. And this is a little coffee-like plant that contains DMT in the roots. One of the great mysteries of ayahuasca is how, out of 475,000 species of plants in the Amazon, these people figured out that you pound the vine and combine it with the leaves and then go through this elaborate boiling and concentrating, and then you get this fantastic visionary beverage. If you ask them how they figured it out, they say the plants told us, which is so far the best answer anybody has come up with. In 1962, Melvin Bristol, who was a graduate student of Richard Evans Schulte's at Harvard, was studying ayahuasca among the Subundoy Indians, and he took ayahuasca, and during the trip, a plant was revealed to him, and he was told that it would be alkaloid positive, and it was alkaloid positive. Well, this is now anecdotally embedded in the literature. Was it dumb luck? Was it synchronicity? Or was it that plants tell you about other plants? The way ayahuasca is used by research pharmacologists in these Amazon tribes is they brew a standard brew. And then if they have a plant that they, for some reason, suspect might have some medical usage, they will put a little bit of that plant into the ayahuasca, and then the ayahuasca will give them a readout on it and explain what it is. I had one of the longest evenings I've ever put in, where I took half a dose of ayahuasca and half a dose of mushrooms, and it was absolutely god-awful. It was different than any bad trip I've ever had. It didn't seem to be about my personality. It seemed to be about core processes. There was a little Pac-Man thing, and I could see it moving through my memory, just chew, 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 and I didn't know. You know that horrifying scene in 2001 where the guy is outside the spaceship and he says, "Open the pod doors, Hal. Open the pod doors, Hal." Well, that's how I felt. I felt I could almost see the molecular machinery had jammed. And I said, "Oh my God, it's not going to deanimate or dealkylate. It's somehow caught in some kind of a loop." And I sweated bullets for an hour and a half with it. It was really horrible. And then it finally released and let me go. But as I sat in that chair, I said, you know, if I can't pull out of this place, then there's a room in a back ward somewhere, and they will just sit me there and look in on me every 12 or 14 hours, and that'll be my story. Yeah.
You said earlier you were surprised that you had no competitors.
Right.
And you understand that we have a political climate that's not congenial to exploring.
True. Because I don't feel particularly courageous. I don't feel that this is unusual, what we're doing here. Am I crazy? Could be. It seems to me perfect. It would seem to me, knowing what I know, which is no more than 1,000 other people know, I couldn't live with myself if I didn't talk about these things. Because our problem is we're disempowered, unhappy, and disconnected from ourselves and each other. Here's the solution. How can you, it's a political obligation, or it's a moral obligation, to try and at least inform people. They don't have to take it, but they should at least have the facts of the matter in front of them as they live their lives. So I just do it because I couldn't do it any other way, and I'm puzzled that nobody else feels this imperative, because the people I talk to, you know, 1,000 people have told me psychedelics were the most important thing that ever happened to them. But not one of those 1,000 people ever said, and I've scheduled a speaking tour to do the same thing that you're doing, so I don't know. Wow. Well, either I'm crazy or they are. I don't know. See, I think that if you confront certain butterflies or deer, there are certain kinds of animals that if you move slowly enough, they can't tell you're there because they're set up for edge detection. And if you move slowly enough, they don't register the edge transiting. So you can actually walk right up to them and grab them if you know how to do it. Lizards are like this. Cats. So I think that by moving with stealth, rather than going to Harvard or Berkeley and inviting the freshman class to pour into the street and smash bank windows, that we can actually slip this thing along. I think that eventually such desperation is going to strike straight institutions that they will come to us and ask. They're going to try everything when the going gets rough, and when they finally decide to drop all their pretension, we'll be perfectly willing to have a dialogue. I'm sorry to hear that people felt that paranoid about it. I don't think the political climate is that repressive. I think people are doing the work of the man for the man by being that paranoid.
In a book from Chocolate, The Morphine was published, this author suffered counter-pressures.
Well, counter-pressures, his book was banned in Florida, but for crying out loud, look at the Russians. They were able to toss out the Communist Party. Well, now that's a pretty scary thing to go up against. We don't have anything comparable to that in terms of its depth of penetration into our lives, and yet they were able to do that. I think, you know, there's more to life than hiding out. You got to make the grand gesture at a certain point and then let the chips fall where they may. Brave words, oh boy.
I agree with you. Do you have something for your audiences, an organization or something that they can support in raising consciousness and changing legislation?
Basically, I think people should see these kinds of meetings as a tremendous opportunity to form local alliances. The last thing on earth we want here is a Terence McKenna cult. That would just be the stupidest resolution of the whole thing. The whole message is, you don't need me or Tim or anybody else. Just, you know, take a little metaphysical responsibility upon yourself. Realize you are the microcosm of the macrocosm. And then get with like-minded people and proceed. I mean, this is how political revolutions are made, is by people just ignoring as irrelevant, outmoded social forms and structures and insisting on their own authenticity.
So you're mentioning MAPS or Hoffman Foundation sort of help?
Oh, it might help people. I mean, how would it help?
Strength in numbers.
Well, I think people should support psychedelic communities, archival projects, legalization moves, yes. But mainly, I think what we all need to do is get more loaded. You know, deeper trips. Higher doses. See, it's not that we want to convert the entire planet to taking mushrooms. It's that we just want to be left alone to do what we want to do. The mushroom, if it's as great as I say it is, then it doesn't need a mob clearing the way for it. It's perfectly able to advance its own agenda. The thing is just not to yield to fear. Because, as I said, if you yield to fear, you do the man's work for the man. And that makes you the man. So what you have to do is just say, well, you know, this is what we do, and eventually it will change. I mean, gay people is a good example. I mean, in our own lifetimes, we've seen this go from, you know, an unspeakable crime against nature, which decent people took care to not even be informed of, to, you know, a political subculture with its own agenda and its own press and its own political clout. Well, we are not as under the thumb as gay people were, say, in the early 50s or something. If they can do it, We can do it. If black people can go from slavery to a legitimate claim on full social integration into the body politic, then we can do it too. But not if we... No, in America, nobody gets nothing unless they demand it. So as long as we bow our heads and hide our stash and are looking over our shoulder, well, then they've got us on the run. But we just have to say, look, this is it. This is who I am. If this doesn't jive with your political agenda, adjust your political agenda, because this is who we are. Well, now let's knock off and regroup for tomorrow on that point. Thanks very much. Well, before we get into this morning's rigid agenda, where were we yesterday? And is there, I recall there were hands up. Do the people who belong to those hands still have the concerns that went with them? Talk about forming local alliances in psychedelic communities. Well, I think, you know, as I said, this is your affinity group. You can't recognize psychedelic people walking around on the street because our victory in the area of fashion has been so total that now even creeps look like freaks. So, yeah, I've been in a number of places where people organized, I don't know what you would call them, discussion groups, affinity groups in the wake of it. It's something you sort of have to self-organize. Maybe in the period after the close this afternoon, the people who are into that should exchange names and get something going. I mean, obviously it's a delicate thing, but on the other hand,
You mentioned the word facilitator once today, and I wanted to know what role that plays for you.
For me? Well, a lot of people feel more secure doing journeys if they have some kind of ground control. And in the most casual form, that can just be your best friend who doesn't do it, but you do. Or if you suspect that fairly deep and charged issues are going to arise out of it, why you want it to be someone with some psychotherapeutic experience. But on the other hand, you know, you're in such a vulnerable state in that dimension that you really want to choose the facilitator carefully. I mean, and have some kind of set of agreements worked out before. I mean, the psychedelic trip doesn't always take the direction you want it to. I mean, you write down before you take it that you want to deal with some episode of childhood trauma or abandonment. Then you get loaded. And it seems so preposterous that, you know, you can hardly contemplate the notion without laughing aloud. And the facilitator keeps trying to bring you back, say, well, you're not doing the work. We're here to do the work. Well, then you say, well, you know, having a knockdown, drag out fight while somebody's loaded isn't exactly the way to go either. You sort of have to feel into that issue. As I said yesterday, I can't get where I want to go in the presence of somebody else because they hold me to the surface. If I were to have my idea of the perfect facilitator situation is that they're two rooms away and you have something equivalent of a beeper. And then, you know, you can beep them and they'll come in and pat you on the head and tell you that it's all right if you need that, but otherwise they stay completely out of it. It's really nice to follow your own thought, you know, and I think we change in the presence of another person, you know, we create a persona. And it takes a lot of energy to maintain the persona. And in that situation, there's no reason, so why do it? Yeah. Well, not exactly. I mean, people always say, can you do it on the natch? And I sort of feel like if I could do it on the natch, I'd be alarmed enough to check myself in for some serious mental health care. It's too radical. You don't want to be able to do that on the natch.
Oh, come on now, Terry.
It's a wonderful control on it to know that it won't happen unless you take the stuff. You know, because it's not a mood shift or a subtle refocusing from foreground to background. It's an absolutely ontology-peeling breakthrough.
You really can't mentally change your body chemistry to actually go to that state without psychedelics.
In principle, I agree with that, and I'm fascinated to try anything anybody has in mind, but you have to be very demanding. And I think too many people are not demanding at all. I mean, you sit people down in a room and tell them we're going to repeat Om Ah Hum 500 times, and at the end of it, they come to you with tears of joy in their eyes and tell you it was the most profound thing that's ever happened to them. I don't understand where those people could be coming from, you know? I mean, it's... I can sit down and like think about being stoned on DMT, and I can give myself the butterflies with that exercise, but not much else. That's as far as I get, you know. Persistently, these various traditions claim that they can deliver the goods. But when you look at the art, which is the paper trail that they leave, it doesn't look like what I'm talking about. You know, I mean, I went through, I once, for a while, I was a professional art buyer for Tibetan art, tankas and that kind of thing. And I interiorized all of that iconography, but it isn't very much like what we're seeing. And, you know, there are a number of highly idiosyncratic artists scattered through the history of art. Gustave Moreau, James Ensor, we mentioned Hieronymus Bosch, Matti Klarlein, but I'm trying to think of older ones. But these seem to be unique visions, but not exactly the vision that seems to come out of this stuff. Part of what's so interesting to me is how alien it is. How if the artist is supposed to be the antenna of society, anticipating the visions which will later become the paradigms, then they're not doing the job very well in this psychedelic domain. Yeah. Or did you have a follow up?
In other ways, but it takes a lot of discipline. And if you do get to that level, it's kind of like you sculpted your present moments. If you're at that level, you can stay there. Whereas, I don't know, I see your way sometimes as you're going in and you come back, you're going in and come back, and you're like, back to where you started.
Well, but this is where the action is. You know, it has to make sense in the world. Now, I don't want to suggest, I mean, I think, like in the case of psilocybin, I have no doubt whatsoever that if you take 5 grams of psilocybin every 4 days for, let's say, 40 days, then you will have nothing whatsoever to say to the rest of us. You know, if what you see, the thing is, in the spiritual quest, all these methods, yoga and mantra, and then, you know, all the new versions of this, the whole stance of the spiritual quester is accelerator to the floor all the time. When you switch over to this method, it's the brake pads that are going to get the workout. We psychedelic people do not strenuously exert ourselves to attain peculiar states of mind. We strenuously exert ourselves to keep the states of mind from becoming too peculiar.
Why?
Why? Because it can become so peculiar that I don't know what. Yes, that's it. It can become so peculiar that it is unspeakable. And if it's unspeakable, it's just dropped out of the social contract, you know?
So really, the reason to maintain it is so that you can get back into the sociological state and communicate. But what I'm thinking is that I'm sure that there are people who have pursued it to the point that they just walked out of this existence and didn't come back.
Yes, well, that's what I wanted to say. If you want to be the guy on Cold Mountain who is covered with hair, who the village people occasionally see when the mist clears, when he descends to the lower levels to cut wood, you can become that Taoist immortal. You know, what I like to say about psychedelics is once you get to this, it's no longer about seeking the answer. It's now a tougher go. Now you have to face the answer. And it's so easy to seek, you know, this rishi, that roshi, that geshe, that guru, and all the wonderful people, and the gossip and hijinks around the ashram, and all that malarkey. But once you get to this, and it's just you and it, you know, it's a whole different ball game. Well, we're talking, there are two things, the experience and the wisdom and maturity that comes from the experience. You don't have to keep dosing to do that, but to attain, maintain, and work out the implications of that. But you have to keep dosing to keep encountering the unspeakable thing that is the source of all that maturation. And so forth. My gosh, everybody's agitated here, yeah.
I wondered if, in your experience in the Amazon or otherwise with shamanic cultures, if you found that they were able to do this without drugs, or whether they were even interested?
No, largely not. In the Amazon, I mean, I discussed this with people, and they said, no, you know, the plant is the teacher. I mentioned, or maybe I didn't, but there's an interesting book called Hauma and Harmaline by Flattery and Schwartz, and it discusses the ambiance of the religious attitudes of early Zoroastrianism, and they believed in what they called the Menang existence. And we're talking, you know, 2000 BC here, and they believed there was no possible way of accessing this spiritual dimension except drugs. That was the entire way to do it. And I think it's a kind of pharmacological and energy barrier. It's good that these things are isolated from ordinary experience by the formality of having to take the compound. If they weren't, it would be flooding in upon us all the time, and we would have a hard time indeed. Yeah.
Well, you speak about people taking the psychedelic repeatedly and gaining experience from that, and then there are these other people, for example, mystics and the Hindu societies and so forth, who practice meditation. I read somewhere recently that the people in the Amazon, I think ayahuasca, it is recommended that they, as an initial effects come on, that they practice mind control. and the combination of that plus taking the like psychedelic, like psilocybin. And you talked to